Hey guys, welcome back to Vertical Momentum. I'm your host, Richard Kaufman, also known as the Comeback Coach. Guys, this is going to be a great episode. Have you ever felt stuck? Have you ever felt like you just don't make a difference anymore? Have you ever felt like I need to get out of this rut? Well, this is the episode you need to talk to, because the gentleman I'm going to talk to today, my friend Brian, is the Swiss Army knife of mindset. He's a coach, author, speaker. He does it all. And not only that, but as I'm a little bit teary-eyed, because this man actually changed my life. I felt at one point I wasn't living intentional, and I was just letting my day rule my life. So definitely check out this episode. You're going to love it. Make sure you subscribe and hit that notification bell. Brian, thank you so much, my brother. I'm truly humbled and grateful to call you friend.
Well, man, I'm happy to be here with you. Grateful for the opportunity. And I'm pretty sure it was our mutual friend, Joe Graham, that got us connected. And so I at least want to give him a shout out as well while we're together, because he's a genuine human being connecting good people with good people. And man, that's how collective impact takes place.
Yeah, guys, if you've never listened to Joe's podcast, 150,000 podcasts, make sure you definitely check him out. So before we even get started, Brian, what is your definition of resilience?
You know, I you told me like 2 minutes ago that you were going to ask me that question first. And it's very, very rare that words don't come quickly for me. And this is one of those, because resiliency means a whole lot to me. It's kind of like been the story of my life. And so I would say that the definition is also connected to one of my core lessons, which is that I learned very early in life not to get stuck by the things that have happened to me, but instead get moved by what I can do with them. And so the reality of it is, resiliency is the ability to move despite resistance, the ability to continue, the ability to stand back up, the ability to survive, and also start to shift into the ability to just be alive.
I love it. Let's hop back in the Wayback Machine. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became the man that you are today.
I always have to start with the current state, which is that I'm a husband and father first. The reality of it is that my wife and my two beautiful children, man, they are everything to me. And that's the only thing binary in my world. So if the three of them aren't good, that means I'm walking away from everything else. At the end of the day, that's all that matters to me. And then secondary, all the impact that we're going to create. But, you know, the origin story, this is one of the things that I seem sometimes get some shock in some people's worlds when I start to tell this. But I'm just going to say for a second, I'm going to expedite the story. August 10th, 1992, 115 degree day, 6:10 p.m. My mom, my brother, and I went to our local Walmart to get a 1-inch paintbrush. And as we headed back to our car, anybody who's known me for about 2.5 seconds knows that I talk fast, I walk fast. I've always had this excitement for life. So it doesn't surprise anybody, I was the first one there. I was standing next to my mom's car waiting for her to unlock the doors. And this was back in the days before there was key fobs. So I had to wait for her to literally reach in her purse, grab the key, stick it in the door, and turn it so we'd run out of the way. And as I was standing there, the driver and middle passenger in a truck parked and got out right in front of the store. Passenger all the way to the right felt the truck moving backwards. So Richard, he did what any one of us would do. Scooter put his foot on the brake, but instead hit the gas. Combination of shock and force threw him up on the steering wheel, up on the dashboard. And before you know it, he's catapulting 40 miles an hour right across the parking lot, right at us with no time to react. Up and over the median, up and over the tree in the median, hit our car, knocked me over, ran over me diagonally, tearing my spleen, leaving a tire track scar in my stomach, and continuing on to completely sever my left arm from my body. I was trying to figure out how to get that in frame there. And so I know that you knew that story because you've been following for a little while, but I'm sure that many of the people listening today didn't. And so what I always have to say in light of this is, yes, I have an extremely, extremely unique story, but we all have unique stories. So what's important is that we learn to pause and become aware of the lessons we can extract from our stories, and then become intentional with how do we apply them in our lives. And we all have the ability to do that. We also all have the ability to tap into the collective wisdom of other people's stories to shorten our own curve to learning. And one thing that I always have to say when I tell this story, and I skipped right over it today, not intentionally, is that the woman who saved my life was a nurse that walked out of the store. She saw the literal life and limb scenario right in front of her. And I am forever indebted to her for choosing to turn into action versus go on with her day. That's a lesson I extracted from her wisdom. And when she came over, she stopped the bleeding on the main wound and saved my life. She also instructed some innocent bystanders to run inside, grab a cooler and fill it with ice to get my detached limb on ice within minutes, give me a fighting chance of having a reattached arm. So it was not for this woman and her decision to go into action to help and benefit me, I either wouldn't be here with you today or I'd be here today with a cleaned up stump.
And I love it. Now look at the shirt I'm wearing. Today I decide.
Right.
The three most important words in the English language. So now talk to me, because, and it doesn't seem to be too far behind. I actually got hurt in the military. I was backing up a Humvee. Instead of him hitting the brakes, he hit the gas and ran over my head. That's why I'm 80% blind. And I got, they ran over my whole body and my head. So I totally get, I can actually see
what you're talking. You might get it even more than I do, bro. You get run over on the head.
So I actually see, you know, where you're coming from. Now, as a little kid, you know, how old were you at this point?
I was 7.
So what was that like the next couple of years having to, you're a different kid now, you know, not only mentally, but physically, and having to come back, you know, as a young child, having to come back from something that most kids will never have to come back from.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie. It wasn't easy in any respect, but it was also some of the greatest foundation that could have been created for my life. You know, I felt sorry for myself very quickly, right? Even at 7, I remember laying in that bed, wondering what the rest of my life would look like and asking questions like, why me? And that first lesson that I shared to define resiliency was what hit me pretty quickly, because as we're laying in the ICU bed, feeling sorry for ourselves, we'd have families coming up to us saying, we're so sorry. We're so sorry for what happened to you. What can we do to help you? How can we help? What can we do to add value into your world? And then we'd learn that their kid's laying in the hospital bed next to me with a terminal illness and doesn't know if they're going to live for another 30 days. Other than the immediate threat to my life, I was going to live. I didn't know at that moment whether or not I would have my arm, but I knew I'd have my life. And so that snapped perspective in very, very quickly. And so I immediately shifted to just, okay, this is my life and this is what I'm going to have to deal with. There's a lot of unintended things that took place. Part of the reason I'm so intentional today is because of the lack of awareness I had around the unintentional creeping of things into my world. You know, I walked out of the hospital. I had a sling. I'd have a teddy bear in between my sling because my arm had to be 90 degrees so that the bone would heal appropriately. And I got very used to seeing jaws hit the ground, faces going white, because people would ask me, hey, what happened to your arm? And expecting me to say, oh, man, I flew off that swing. I beat my buddy. I crashed my bike. I whatever, right? And I'd look at them deadpan in the eye. I was run over by a truck and my arm got torn off. And immediately they would pause and they would look at my parents for validation because they didn't believe my own story. Now, I don't blame them. It's not a story you hear often. It's not something that you would expect coming out of a 7-year-old, just so matter of fact. But that's not something I understood or had perspective on when I was 7, because that was my reality. And so what it did was really start to make me believe that the world didn't believe my own stories. And so I started putting up layers of armor to protect myself. And I created a mental narrative that said, Brian's good, Brian's strong, Brian's capable, and he can do anything himself, right? And this was a byproduct of that, but also the secondary piece of the number of people that viewed me through their lens of what they'd be capable of in my situation. And so they'd immediately start layering limitations on, well, Brian's not gonna be able to do that again. Brian will never be able to do that again. Well, Brian, he's gonna struggle with that. And I didn't ever wanna be defined by other people's limitations. So part of our concept around no limits truly started back then, because I was not going to be defined by anybody else's limitations. And that was the time that I started to realize that the only limitations are the ones that we place upon ourselves.
You know, I received that, because I know that, you know, after I've been through a lot, and I've come back from drug addiction, alcoholism, homelessness, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, blindness, and it seems like I have an extra sense or extra strength that a lot of people don't have. Cause I like you realize, you know, other people say, well, you know, you can't have a top 10 podcast because you're blind or because you have a traumatic brain injury. But I say, you know, I'm living in the bonus right now. I'm not supposed to be here. So there's nothing that I can't do. Is that the kind of mindset you started to have?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I had the words for it when I was 7, 8, and 9, right? But today it's very clear. I just got a very healthy relationship with mortality at a very young age, right? And when you start to realize like that every day is a gift beyond what you had prior, I mean, I literally could have died and bled out in that parking lot. When you lose a major limb, it happens like that. It's not long, right? And so I could have died that day. And there was multiple situations afterwards. And so now it's very easy for me to recognize just that. I have a healthy relationship with mortality. And so every day is a gift, but that also means that I want to maximize every day as it relates to how I want to live my life. Because I could just sit on a couch and do nothing. And I don't say that to vilify anybody who's in a position that's doing that, but that's not how I choose to live my life, right? That's not how I want to exist in this world. And so I can, again, get stuck by the things that have happened to me, or I can extract the lessons that I can from them and move through them in a way that I can live not restrained by those situations. And to your point exactly, my question is like, why not? Why not? I was on a show yesterday with a 15-year-old entrepreneur who's got a phenomenal business. It's been building, growing, and scaling. And he said, well, what message do you have for me as a 15-year-old? Because I keep telling people to tell me that I should slow down, that a 15-year-old can't have this size business, that I can't actually have this level of success and actually operate in the world. And his whole business is around spirituality, mentality, emotions, and it's deeply historic, but he's being told by the world that he can't. Now, he hasn't had the death and brush with mortality like you and I have had, but sometimes we just need to speak life into people, because that's what I think you and I have an appreciation for, is just that, life. Our ability to live is the gift. So if we can center ourselves in this moment, then we're only confined and defined and limited based on the things that we choose to limit ourselves. You know, that's just how I view the world, brother.
Yeah, and one thing I always say, I believe in generational curses, but I also believe in generational blessings.
Absolutely.
You know, and I believe that we either speak life into our children or we speak death into our children. So if you're a parent, just please write that down. You're either speaking life into your children or death. So I just wanted to put that out there, because, you know, something that you said earlier, it really affected me about, you know, how you had to come back at such an early, early age. But now you have beautiful children, you have your bride, and you're speaking life into your children every day. So I just wanted the public.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I want to give a little bit of a clarifying point to extend your thought further for other people. We need to be really paying attention to who our kids are and how they receive information, because there's times that we may believe we're speaking life into them when it feels and is being received like we're speaking death into them. And so even with good intent, I think we have to really make sure that we're going that extra level to communicate, to really understand what we're resonating and connecting with our kids. Can I give an example of what I mean by this?
Yeah, I'm all ears. I'm listening.
My son is very much like me, which means that in our household, he's the one that triggers me the most, because I see the areas that he's got limitations and blocks that I resonate with from 30 years ago. I understand some of the ways that he enters into the world, how he communicates with people. And so I recognize that there's abilities for me to shorten his curve to learning so that he doesn't have to go through some of the same challenges I might have had to, for a variety of different reasons. Because I know my son, I am never of the belief that anything that I'm going to put into his world is intended to portray or advance my initiative. Meaning, I don't want to layer on or pressure on my beliefs on what's good for him. I want to extend and support the things that he defines are good for him. There are times that in sports, I know his desire to perform. I know his desire to connect with his team. I know his desire to do certain things. And I'm never one of those parents that's on the sideline. Like, failure to me is a gift. And at the end of the day, at age 8, he's out there to have fun, to learn, and to connect. So I don't care about the performance, but I care about that. I want him to have fun. I want him to learn, and I want him to connect. And so if he, because he's on the spectrum, has any blocks to that, and I think it'll help him advance to the areas that he wants to connect better, I'll sometimes give advice. Sometimes it's received. Often it's not. Last week at our game, and I'm very, very intentional with all of my clients, with my associates, with my wife, with so many of my friends, to always ask permission before I give feedback or speak into them. If I see something, I have a hard time, like you said, if I see something or I know something, I have a hard time not doing it. Right? I have a hard time not saying something. So if I see a way that I can help someone, I often want to speak into that. But I learned a long time ago that most people aren't always ready to receive that. And so I always ask permission. Hey, if I see something, could add value into your world? Would you want to hear about it? Right? Do you mind if I speak into you? Those types of things. I don't always do that with my son. Even though I know that what I'm doing is for his best interest based on what I believe aligns with him, I don't always ask permission. So last week at football, they were warming up. They were practicing. He got to be quarterback. They gave him the whiteboard. He drew up plays. He was doing this. There was a couple of areas where he just wasn't hearing or connecting with what the coach was saying or what the team was saying. And so I was like, okay, this might be an area that I could help him. I could raise a level of awareness for him in this moment. But for whatever reason, when he came over to me on the sideline, I paused. And in that moment, instead of giving feedback like I have so many other times in a way that was truly wrapped in love to support him and help him, I said, hey, dude, if I had something that I think could help you better connect, better understand and communicate with your coach or your team, or perform better on the field, do you want me to share it with you? Or do you just want me to cheer regardless? He paused and he said, the second one. I believed I was speaking life into him, but he was receiving it as criticism. And no matter how much I wrapped it with love and gave intention around those words, at the end of the day, if he's not open to receive it, it's going to feel as if I'm speaking death into him. And so that's why I wanted to clarify your point, because the quote you had everybody write down is phenomenal. But where I want to go a level further is, are we actually aware enough to understand that what we're speaking into our kids is being received as life or being received as death? Because it's only a matter of how they're receiving it, not about how we're delivering it.
You know, and I love it because I also, are you sure we're not related somehow? I actually have a son. He has Asperger's, which is on the spectrum.
Yep.
But he's in college right now. He's kicking ass. So I totally get how sometimes we have to say a different way in order to, you know, for a child that is on the spectrum. So if parents out there with children on the spectrum, make sure you guys are watching.
But I'm going to say that that's true for everybody, neurotypical as well, right? Let's just always make sure that what we're positioning is actually being received the way we intend it.
Okay, so now what kind of kid were you in high school? Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to college. I was an overachiever, but I was also one that wasn't going to be defined by anybody else. So, you know, I started my first business when I was 11. I started my second business when I was 13. And I had a well-running landscape and yard maintenance business with 40 clients by the time I was 14. In my yard. And so I was working multiple afternoons, multiple weekends, because I wanted to create a life for myself. And I wanted to start to prove to myself that I could be independent in multiple different ways. And so, and I also didn't want to just sit around even in high school. And my parents weren't the type that gave us allowance. So if I wanted something, I went out to go get it. Right. And so that was just often like what I had created. I worked truly as a teenager. I had a lot of fun in high school. I played sports. I was a tennis pro for a few years and ran actually a couple of different tennis shops as well from the time I was 15 till the time I was about 18. So I had a lot of very, very early entrepreneurial and business experience, actually running some small businesses on behalf of the owners at a very young age. So I had a lot of fun. I went thinking I was going to play tennis in college. And I quit a month before I went to school because I just was burned out. I'd been on the court 70 hours a week between teaching and playing for the prior 4 years. And it just was getting to a place where it just wasn't serving me anymore. And I wanted to have a different experience in college. I went to a small private school in Southern California called University of Redlands. And, you know, long story short, not only was it one of the best 4 years of my life, but that's where I met my wife. And so I genuinely believe it's where I was meant to be at that time in my life. And I got to learn, grow, spread my wings. And I got far enough away from Phoenix that I got to actually establish some independence beyond my family and my friends and my relationships, which really just broadened my perspectives. And so, I was a good student. I was a good athlete. I was a good friend. But I was also very disconnected from myself. And I didn't realize that until far later.
So what did you major in college?
I got a Bachelor of Science in Business and I got a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology.
Okay, which I think psychology and business go friggin'
hand in hand. Yeah.
But I talked to a guy yesterday. He graduated from USC and with a master's in business. And he said, you know, most of the people that taught me never started a business. Everything they taught me was theory.
That's right.
And, you know, but then, so he's like, when I got my MBA and I hit the streets and I go to start my business, he's like, I know about theory, but I don't know what to do.
Different world, bro. Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think I was pretty fortunate because although most of that was true, even in my school, because of the nature of the school and the small element of it, the business school was actually a lot of entrepreneurs were professors. And so we had a very established business program. And so I feel like I got a pretty healthy balance. But again, I'd been working in my own small businesses and running some other ones as a teenager already at that point for 8 years before the time I got into college. And so not that I had any knowledge or understanding, but I had the ability to filter that a little bit through right products and merchandise and cash flow and what are we doing and inventory and all of the above. And so there was elements of it that I understood just because of the experience that I had. However, come out into the world, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, wanting to take over the corporate world, I'll tell you what, a business degree doesn't give you everything you need by a long stretch. And so, you know, I spent 15 years in risk management and employee benefits consulting. I spent the first five at a publicly traded company after doing an internship where I just had some really amazing opportunities very early to help create some, ultimately, accounting softwares that was able to find lost commissions and revenues or ones that hadn't actually billed despite what we had set up in the system. And so that gave me like very early opportunity because I think the program that we helped write in that first summer ended up finding over $1 million of lost revenue for the organization I was interning with. And so it just leaned me right into the insurance field. And that's where I started my career.
All right. So like, first I want to thank our sponsors. First of all, without you guys, the show would not go on. I came out with my own coffee because when I was growing up, I loved energy drinks, but now I became an old man. I'm only allowed to have one a day. So I created my own coffee, which is Vertical Momentum Coffee. Beautiful. Twice the amount of caffeine, no crash, tastes amazing. But the best part is 100% of the proceeds go to help veterans struggling with homelessness and PTSD. So if you guys love coffee and you love a mission, definitely check out Vertical Momentum Coffee. Write the word coffee down below and I'll send you the information. Now, for me, I did 23 years in the military. I would have done 30 if I didn't get hurt. And, you know, in the military, we're taught how to follow an SOP, standard operation procedures. But when we get out, you know, we want to start a company. We want to start. And I've done this, so I can actually laugh about it myself. You know, we get out, we want to start a T-shirt company, hat company, liquor, coffee. And then 6 months later, you know, we're $10,000 in debt and don't know what the hell just happened. And I think a lot of it has to do with not being intentional. We're just, you know, instead of being like a sniper, we just pray and spray everywhere. So please, you know, talk to us a little bit about, you know, being intentional in business and relationships.
Yeah. So I have to start because you can't be intentional with what you're unaware of. And so intention is absolutely how we apply it into the world. But awareness is where it starts, I believe. You know, our minds process 11 million bits of information per second, but we're only consciously aware of about 40, right? So that suggests just by itself that we largely live in the unconscious, which doesn't surprise us now when most people claim that they're victims and that life is fate and that they have no influence or control of their destinies. Because until you go through a systematic process of moving the unconscious to conscious, the unaware to the aware, you cannot be intentional. So I have to say that we always have to start with awareness of self, internal and external self-awareness, but also awareness of the environment, situations, and things that we're operating in business with. Because if we don't have a knowledge, we don't have an understanding, we don't have awareness, right? Then we need to be aware that we don't know what we don't know so that we can be intentional with finding the information that we need to put us in the right position. So it doesn't matter what situation we're in. I would argue that we need to really make sure that we understand ourselves first, whether we're talking about building an effective intentional process in relationships or in business. I believe they're one and the same. Relationships are business. Business is relationships. And so that's why so much of the content and the way that we speak is a very holistic nature, because I don't believe in work-life balance. I believe in work-life integration. We have one life. And guess what? It's people before profits and who before what, because everything we do involves people. Even if you're in a tech company that largely is SaaS-based, there are people that have helped build the software. There's people that help deploy the software. And there are people that use the software. So people are touching everything we do. So if you don't know who you are, how are you going to properly demonstrate who you are to the world through your actions and intentionality in your relationships and your business? And so I think so often, right, to your point exactly, whether it's veterans or whether it's somebody who gets an idea that says, oh, I can go sell this because I know it's hot in the marketplace right now. I know I can get into hats. I know I can get into T-shirts. Just because you can monetize something doesn't mean it's always a good idea to do so. The reality of it is so often when people chase monetization or the what before getting clear on the who am I and who are we as the business? Who are we doing this for? Who are we doing this with? And who are we going to impact as a result of it? If you don't understand the who's in your world, then how do you effectively be intentional with relationships or business? And so going out and setting up strategies and tactics, you even outlined it very, very clearly, right? So often in the military, you are conditioned and you have behavioral patterns that are a result of predetermined standard operating procedures that get deployed through the entire military, right? Whatever division you're in, whatever practice and specialty you have, there is an SOP that gets pushed down. This is how you live your life. This is how you do your job. This is how you interact with your hierarchies and superiors and new folks. And this is how you act with civilians. Like, it's literally outlined. And I say that with no vilification. It's just the truth, right? And so if you understand that standard operating procedures are truly an embodied behavioral pattern that is conditioned in, then that also requires that you can either learn how to leverage those existing standard operating procedures and how do you actually move through the world, or you recognize that they may be some layers that you need to shed. See, most people think that they're stuck, or the only way to build a business is if you find the right strategy and tactics, the right set of operating procedures. And they're critically important for leveraging and scaling our lives and our businesses. But strategy and tactics are not the things that keep us stuck. So the reality of it is when all of a sudden we're $10,000 in debt and asking ourselves what just happened, it has nothing to do with the strategy and tactics that went out to it, because the foundation wasn't set, because the who wasn't clear in the beginning.
I think your camera froze. Yep, your camera froze, and I can see you. I can't hear you, so hopefully it's going to pop back on again. But I totally agree what you're talking about. It's amazing how, like, I've lost a couple businesses because I didn't follow an SOP. Let me see. So, guys, I'm just trying to get him back on again. Hold on a second. Don't know what happened. Hopefully, we'll get him back on again. Like I said, guys, what he's talking about, and I'm going to try to get him to come back on again. Is about, you know, definitely working on your standard operating procedures. Because sometimes we just, like he said, you know, one of my favorite quotes, and I'm gonna keep getting on him as we're talking. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, you don't know what you don't know. So hold on a second. Hold on. Trying to get him back on, guys. We're going to try to get him back on again. I sent him another invite. But, you know, I lost a couple businesses because I did not get the right information. You know, like he talked about, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I didn't know, you know. So what I did is I had to go join a mastermind. I had to start taking courses. Like I took some courses by Mr. Travis Johnson. I took some courses by John Lee Dumas. I took some courses by Zach Babcock. So I actually took some more courses so I can learn what to do. Because I didn't know, like you said, I didn't know what I didn't know. So sometimes, you know, you might have to, if you want to get where you're going, sometimes you might have to spend a little money and, you know, become a part of a mastermind. Invest in some courses. I invested in Audible to where I'm listening to two or three books a week. So that's something that I do because I'm constantly trying to learn. I'm constantly trying to be a better podcaster, to be a better host, to be a better interviewer. So hold on one second. I'm trying to get it back. And we are back.
We are sort of. We have the whole power on the entire block went down. So I'm trying to do this from my phone. It literally just disappeared.
No way. So I was just talking to, sometimes, like you said, you don't know what you don't know. So sometimes you have to become part of a mastermind. You might have to take some courses. You might have to ask for help. And I think a lot of veterans have that problem saying, listen, I need help. So, yeah. That's what I was talking to him about while I was trying to get you back on.
Beautiful. Well, hopefully this will work. I don't normally join StreamYard from my phone, but here we go.
You look amazing. So now talk to us. Like you said, you don't know what you don't know. So how did you become the man that you are, what you're doing today? How did you get into the space that you're in?
So I would tell you that I've become the man I am today largely because of the people that are around me, my wife, but I have also said that I've only ever been as good as my questions. And so truly what you even just outlined on asking for help, I've asked for a lot of help for a lot of years. And I will tell you that I didn't always ask for help directly because I wasn't always in a position where I was open to receive help directly. But I always asked good questions to at least extract the information and lessons I could from others so that I could find a way to apply that in my own life. And I've done that since as long as I can remember. But I'll tell you how I got into the work that I'm doing today, because I told you I was 15 years in risk management, employee benefits consulting. We scaled the business to over 15 million in the last 10 years with some of my business partners and had a blast. But I woke up really after 6 months after having my son, and realized that I wasn't the husband, man, and father that I always said I was going to be, meaning I wasn't actually deploying things in a way that was consistent with who I was. I wasn't actually showing up in the way that I wanted. And so I hired my first coach, right? So even to your whole point, I didn't know what I didn't know. It was the first time in my life that I don't feel like I had the intellect, the knowledge, the skill set, or any ability to tap into individuals in my own life to get the answers I needed to become the man I wanted to be. And so I went and hired my first coach. Now I interviewed 14, and the first 13 were an inch deep and a mile wide. And the last one finally resonated, had relevance and credibility. And it was only a month into working with him that he said, Brian, you got to be doing this. I said, what are you talking about, bro? And he goes, dude, you build people and you build businesses and you do it all the time. He's like, why wouldn't you put yourself in a position to get paid for it? And I'm like, yeah, whatever, dude. I'm paying you a lot of money not to tell me how great I am, but tell me, figure out these other things. Well, it turns out he told me what I needed to hear and not what I wanted to hear. And about 9 months later, after he trickled it, the world sent me a sign that I couldn't refuse. And I jumped in with both feet. Now, I ran my coaching business side by side with my other business for about 5 years until 2019. My wife and I had a conversation, and she ultimately was another position of telling me something I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. See, I had some other health stuff that took place a couple of years prior to that. And she basically had a conversation with me and said, hey, honey, I feel like you've allowed fear to enter into your world in a way that I've never seen. She said, I feel like you're barely scratching the surface of your potential. And I know you're not having nearly the impact on the world that you want. She said, I also know that every day you live in risk management, employee benefits consulting, you die a little bit inside and you don't see it. She said, what we need is 100% of you and we don't have it. So I don't care if we live in a cardboard box on the corner. She's like, we need 100% of you. But she said, I also know we took a major bet on you once and it paid off big time. Why don't we double down on that bet and go see the impact we can have on the world? Fast forward a couple of months, I put in notice to my business partners that I was going to execute my buy sell at the end of that fiscal year. And June of 2020, I've now been doing this full time. And I really leveraged the digital platform over the course of 2020. And I went really aggressively towards trying to figure out who I wanted to do this with, who I wanted to align with. And because I was getting very, very clear at that moment on who we wanted to impact. You see, we want to impact over a billion lives as quickly as possible. What that means to me is I want to reduce the level of suffering on this planet. Now, that can mean a variety of different things, but I think the majority of suffering that we all experience is internal. And so often when I talk about suffering, I think the roots of most internal suffering come in the things that are left unsaid, the things that we lack permission to feel or say, the things we lack the words to articulate, or the things that are left undone. My purpose in life is to allow my truth to give others permission to live theirs. And so every time I lean into vulnerability, every time I talk about my stories, every time we put a framework out for someone to be able to move through the challenges, the emotional triggers, the behavioral patterns, the environmental conditioning, or the armor that they continue to carry, every time I do that, it addresses these middle two. It gives people permission to feel and say things that they maybe haven't otherwise. And it gives them words to articulate the situation that they're in so that they can continue to move.
Okay. Now, one thing that, you know, like when the conversation first started, you said, if my wife and my kids come first, everything else comes afterwards. Now, I had Mr. David Meltzer on, a friend of ours, you know, David.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, he and I do a lot together.
You know, and he talked about how his wife gave him an ultimatum after he went to the Grammys with Little John, said, listen, it's either me or your lifestyle. One of them's got to go. Mm-hmm. So he actually claimed bankruptcy, lost over $100 million at the age of 34.
Yep.
And turned and changed his life to where he has non-negotiables.
Yep.
He makes time for his daughter's grandma. Yep. He makes, you know, he puts it in his schedule. And now, you know, his company with Warren Moon, you know, they're worth over $20 billion. Mm-hmm. But because I think it's because he had the non-negotiables. And I think once you start, like for me, and I say this every day, for me, it's God, family, business, everything else comes later, if it comes at all. So talk to us about having those non-negotiables.
Yeah, I think they're essential. Look, and I think they really come in a couple of different ways. Non-negotiables are really the standards for how you set you for yourself and for your life and the things that you're not willing to sacrifice. Like I said, my wife and kids are the only thing that are binary to me. And so the reality of it is everything else has some element of gray. Right? My wife and kids, it's black and white. They aren't good. And if it's a result of the business that we're building, the impact we're creating, all the businesses get shut down and I turn into my wife and kids. But everything else has gray area, right? And so I have non-negotiables as it relates to my health. My hierarchy is this. And I believe that investing in you is the least selfish thing you can do, despite the fact that most people believe it is selfish and they can't justify doing it. You cannot pour from an empty cup. If I'm going to impact a billion lives, brother, I better damn well be full. Right? Which means that I have to put myself in the position to be able to be mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally aligned, not only with who I am, but to be able to move through, reduce the resistance and energy drain that exists in my life so that I can remove that interference and continue to move. For me, I've got a 2-hour morning routine because I deal with a great level of pain, as I'm sure you would expect. You probably have had a variety of pain. Now, my pain is truly just pain. It's no longer suffering. It's not debilitating. It does not impact the quality of my life because I know the things I can do every single day to put myself in a position to be okay. So this morning was a great example. Twice a week, I go to a clinic where I do compression therapy across my whole body, red light therapy, infrared sauna, and cold plunges twice so that I'm not only giving my body the ability to get my inflammation down, but I'm also hitting my autonomic nervous system so that brain fog, cognitive functioning, all of those things can operate at its highest level. I have stuff every single day that I do, and my kids and my wife are a part of that rhythm and routine. So I have time dedicated every single day where I am committed and I am shut down and I am focused on them whenever I'm in town. And so as long as I look at those, it's very, very important for me to recognize that these are the things. Now, I call non-negotiables in a lot of cases in our world imperatives. What is imperative for me to do or be to fulfill who I'm becoming and the things that I want to accomplish in my life, right? So leverage is one of my imperatives. I must create leverage in my life. Because the only way we can impact a billion lives, the only way we can have collective impact, it's not going to be Brian Boger that does it. It's going to be an element through leverage and scale. So everything I do, I filter through three questions. Is this something that only I can do? Is this something that someone else can do? Is this something that even needs to be done? Now, that doesn't mean that I push off every single thing if the answer isn't only me, but it's at least entering into it from a position of awareness so I can be extremely intentional through understanding how to delegate and apply leverage and scale through people's systems and truly technology. And so that's an imperative in my world. An imperative also in my world is peak physical condition. Because the only way that I can do and be the person that I want is if I truly am operating in a place that I am deeply aligned in my body, mind, and soul. The only way I can move at the level that I need to is if I mitigate pain, which means I have got to keep inflammation down. I have to pay attention to the things that I'm putting in my body as well as the things I'm doing to move my body so that it can stay consistent. Because if I'm not aligned physically, it will impact mentality, it'll impact emotional state, and it'll impact my spiritual belief. So every single morning, in addition to my body work, I have quiet time and breath work to be able to center myself through meditation and consciousness work to get the downloads I need for the world and to truly center in who I am. Because again, I do all of that before 6 a.m., before anybody needs anything from me, because that's the only time of day that I have 100% control of my time when nobody is tapping into what they need from me. So I can make it all about me as long as I'm willing to put the time, energy, and effort into creating the intention in those reps that I need to do regularly and consistently.
And, you know, that's one thing that I love. My friend James Clear wrote an amazing book, Atomic Habits.
Atomic Habits, yep.
And, you know, and my friend Ed Mylett, that's something that he really talks a lot about is, you know, your evening routine and your morning routine, your next day is going to depend on your evening and morning.
It starts the night before.
So talk about a little bit about your evening, your wind down, and then your wind up routines.
Yeah. So my wind down routine starts typically when I'm in town between 5:30 and 6 p.m. And that's when I typically will go inside to be with my family. So whether I've had meetings out all day or we're working in our casita in our office, whatever we're doing, depending on how, where and how I am, if I'm in town, I'm typically in my house by 6 p.m. because 6 p.m. is family time for me. I have typically an hour and a half to 2 hours between 6 and 7, 7:30, 8 at the latest, typically. Where we are all going to be intentional and together. We have dinner together most nights of the week when I'm in town, and it's time that I get to spend intentional time with both my kids, learning about their days, getting downloads, and hearing how they're processing what they experienced well before bedtime. Since my kids have been babies, my wife and I have always had a bedtime routine with them. So 2 hours of my day, almost every day when I'm in town, is committed to my wife and my kids, where I can be very, very intentional, and we have a bedtime routine with them. So then my next level of wind down, what I didn't mention is before I go in the house at six, my primary phone, I have two phones. My primary phone, the one that I'm operating right now, the one that the whole world has access to me on, stays in my office. I leave it in the office until after the kids go to bed because I want zero distractions from the outside world when I'm paying attention to and investing in my inside world. And so I literally intentionally remove the ability for the outside world to get access to me for 2 hours every evening. After they go to bed, I'll typically touch base and reconnect, look at my phone again, and reconcile anything that needs to be addressed that evening before the next day. And I also look at my calendar, understand what I'm prepping for, and then I begin my prep. Because if I'm, whether I'm going to hot yoga at 4:30 in the morning, I'm doing these other things, or I've got to get myself prepped in my own gym, the reality of it is I get everything I need for the next morning ready the night before so that I have zero resistance when I get up the next day. I don't like friction in the morning. I like to be able to lean right into what I do. And so I get my water bottles ready. I get my clothes ready. I get anything else that I would need ready. And then I reconcile everything that I have from a work standpoint because I typically don't touch anything with work again until 6 or 6:30 in the morning because I don't touch this phone until after my morning routine. And the reason I do that is I don't want outside noise influencing how I'm centering myself. And so typically the very first thing I do when I wake up is I start with meditation. Brainwaves from sleep state are very common to higher levels of consciousness and meditative brainwave states. So it's very easy to get yourself into an out-of-body experience and open yourself up for downloads right on the tail end of sleep. So for me, I just remove the friction. I immediately go into my meditation chair and I start my breath work. That's the very first thing I do every day. From there, the routine looks slightly different because I'm not one that's like, I'm going to do 15 minutes here and 15 minutes here and 15 minutes here. But I have some element of focus on mind, body, soul, emotion, and spirit all in the morning before my family's awake.
Okay. Now, one thing, you know, I love talking to some, you know, world changers and game changers and thought leaders like yourself, Ed, Tony Robbins, and almost 100% of people that are successful in life, like David told me, he said, you know, that gratitude and anger cannot occupy the space, same space. And a lot of us, like for me, I go to bed and I pray and I list three things that I'm grateful for. And then if when I wake up in the morning, if my eyes open and I'm able to see something, everything is gravy after that. I'm very grateful. So you seem like a guy that has a lot of gratitude in his life. Could you just touch on a little bit of gratitude?
Yeah, I do have a lot of gratitude in life, but I will be honest, this is something that I've struggled with, right? I've struggled in my life with being able to truly and deeply appreciate the things that are right in front of me and the things that I have done and the things that I have had and the impacts and moments, right? And part of that is because to our conversation earlier, right? I always believe in recognizing what's possible. And I believe in helping people see what's possible beyond those limitations. And so for me, whatever's in front of me, I've always had this perception on that, well, there could be more. There could be more opportunity. And so I just have to own from a position of vulnerability before I even answer this, that this is something that took me a very, very long time. And it's something I still work on every day. I don't believe that any of these things, by the way, there's any final destination, right? You're listening to any thought leader, any person who's established this, anybody who's teaching these things, if they don't absolutely exist and embody the fact that they still deal with these things on a regular and consistent basis in some form or fashion. Now, the impact is not going to be as great in their lives anymore because they've really moved through it significantly. But the reality of it is these are typically adversaries in constant pursuit until the day we die. We don't escape them. We have to be vigilant in our effort to actually stay ahead of these things from a position of awareness and intentionality. You know, I love that this concept exists around how gratitude and anger cannot coexist. And I do agree with that. But I think where that sometimes leads people astray is I don't think that you can fabricate gratitude. And so for me, I think that's where I struggled is it's like I can move myself to this place where I intellectually create a narrative that I'm grateful, I'm thankful, and I'm appreciative. But if I don't embody that, if I don't have the mind and heart connection around that gratitude where I can feel the gratitude, then it's really just shifting my mindset and not actually paying attention to the emotion underneath that needs to be addressed. And so I do believe that gratitude and anger cannot coexist. And I do believe that we need to always be looking for the ways that we can be gratitude, where we can intellectually and emotionally feel appreciation and gratitude in our lives. But sometimes those negative emotions create so much interference that you can't just shift your mind and say, I'm going to be grateful. That's where the core of our work really gets into place, because I'm a big believer that we've got to unroot those emotional triggers. Anger, first of all, is a secondary emotion. It's not a primary emotion. So if you're feeling anger around something, my guess is it's connected to a deeper emotion, often somehow tied to shame. But the reality of it is I'm a big believer in allowing ourselves to feel so that we can heal. And so I'm not a big believer in shoving emotions down. And I'm also not a believer in creating just a strong mindset, which is a big thing that's out there in the space. If you've got a good mindset, a good mental narrative, and you've got mental toughness, then you can do anything. But the reality of it is I had a very solid mindset. I had a very solid mental toughness and I reached high levels of performance, but it also helped me cause and lose who I was because I'd chased all the what's of the world based on what I'd conditioned to do. And I'd shoved so many feelings down or shut them off just to be able to operate and show up with a smile on my face that I was no longer going to live that way. I believe that you cannot fabricate or manipulate the negative emotions. You have to find a way to actually remove, reduce, or diffuse it in your world. And so if you're experiencing anger, yes, find ways to be grateful. Actually embody that wherever you possibly can. I am 1,000% on board with that. And I love that that's one of the things that one of my best friends in this world, David Meltzer, promotes. And it's true. But again, to the point earlier on recognizing the things that keep us stuck are not typically the wrong strategy and tactics. This is a mental mindset and strategic shift in the way that we think, but not necessarily in the way that we feel. And those are very important because the highest performers understand whether they're hardwired intellectually or emotionally first, and they learn how to tap into and receive both signals and can balance and regulate between them both because guess what? They both lie to us and they both tell us the truth. So sometimes we just have to see which one is real in the moment.
You know, something I love about what you talk about is, you know, like I've been in recovery 33 years, going on 34 years, and they talk a lot about how you have to clear the wreckage of the past. And for me, like I have a 12-week program that I coach people about the three pillars of forgiveness. You know, first you got to forgive people that have hurt you, not forget, but forgive. You know, ask for forgiveness for people that you've hurt and try to make amends. But third of all is forgiving ourselves. So we don't have to carry that stuff. So that's something I truly love about you. But I wrote something down because, you know, once I lost my vision, my hearing got a lot better.
Not
according to my wife, but
hearing and listening are two different things, Richard.
But, you know, I've become very intentional with my listening.
Yeah.
And you've said something at least 7 times already when you're not home. So that means you must be out on the road a lot. And I wanted to ask, the reason I wanted to ask that, because a lot of the people that are listening are active duty soldiers, and they're going to be deployed somewhere in the next 6 to 12 months. So how do you maintain the relationship with your wife and your kids while you're not home?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Richard, thank you for bringing it back to that and also reminding me the element of the audience, because two things. One, I want to thank you for your service. And I want to thank your family for your service. And I want to do the same thing for every single person listening. It's not lost on me that anybody who's in the military, that means their family's in the military as well.
Yeah.
It means that everybody is actually being impacted by this situation, this choice, whether it's the individual doing it or the whole family that's supporting it. The reality of it is it impacts everybody. And so it's critically important. And I am deeply grateful, truly, and I feel that to my core, for every single one of the individuals in our world who sacrifices elements of their life, their safety, their freedoms in some ways to ensure that the rest of us have it. Just like I was told by somebody earlier that they would have wished that they could serve. My dad was in the Air Force. Military has existed in my family. And I always would have liked to serve. I just wasn't able to because of my arm. And so I'm just deeply grateful for anybody who's put us in that position. But to answer your question, it's a work in progress. I'm just going to be honest, right? My wife does not necessarily love to talk on the phone or love to talk on FaceTime, her with us. And I don't completely disagree. It doesn't give us the same level of connection that we have when we're together. And so that's something that as my kids have started to get older, it's easier for me to establish holistic relationships in the house, because it's not going to to speak to my kids doesn't require sacrifice from my wife. So both of our kids don't have cell phones, but they have those gizmo watches where they've got limited ability. Yeah. And so when I'm on the road, we make it a special point where I send them voice notes every single morning, where I get on the phone with them and communicate at least a few minutes every single day and give them updates about what I'm doing. And because they're so interested in what I'm doing in my world, I try to include pictures around the event that I'm at, or the people that we're working with, or what we're doing, so that they have some semblance of where Dad is and what he's doing. And then I just have an intentional checkpoint with them every single day where I get a download on their day and get to check in just like I would in my 2 hours when I'm home. My wife and I, that's why I say it's still a work in progress. My kids are 6 and 8, right? So how will that look in another 2 or 3 years when they maybe get a cell phone and I can FaceTime with them and they've got more access to call me, right? And then as my wife, you know, either continues to not want to go down that path in extended long conversations, or if we find another way to connect, what we're starting to do, frankly, is be able to have her travel with me on certain trips where it makes sense. Have the kids travel with me on certain trips where it makes sense. That is truly integrating them in my life versus just keeping contact with them when I'm gone.
I love that. So now, like I said, when you first came on, I think you're the Swiss Army knife of positiveness. And also, so I know you're an author, keynote speaker. So talk to us about some of the stuff you have going on, some of the stuff you've written, and what you got going on today.
Yeah, so obviously to impact a billion lives, we've got a lot of things in a lot of different directions, and we kind of need to do it that way. And so, you know, some of the things I'm really, really excited about, we have finally launched our No Limits community. We have been asked for a few years to pull together a community and actually have a regular place that is a safe space for individuals to come in and connect and learn the elements of the human experience, learn how to effectively move through our emotional triggers, learn how to embrace pain to avoid suffering, and be a community that helps promote, elevate, and empower each other. And so that has been launching over the course of the last couple of months, and I'm really excited about the traction we're getting and the individuals jumping into that. We also, earlier this year in January, launched and beta tested a group coaching model, which is called No Limits Us. And No Limits Us is groups of 8 to 12 people typically entrepreneurs, typically individuals who have interest in growing their lives and their businesses, where we really give them a framework and guide them through our No Limits You, our philosophy on building your life of intentional alignment, but also go through, again, this structure, really creating this place where individuals can come and learn from each other, learn and grow effectively, not just from me, not just from our content, but as a community and a connected element in a small group that we can have a tight container where all of us get to learn and grow together. Those two things I'm really, really excited about because those are new additions to our world. We've largely been one-to-one coaching. And although there's many different ways that we engage in that, we've been there, we've had our course, and we've also had a lot of stuff in the speaking world. But to be able to have a place where groups of people can connect, create collective impact together, that just really, really excites me. And then we've got some other businesses as well that are really, I'm really excited about. So every one of our entities hits on some element of helping someone discover who they are, who they're doing this for, who they're doing this with, or who they're going to impact. We have two businesses that are designed to help people introduce who they are to the world and attract who they want to impact. One of them is in a one-to-one targeted way. One of them is in a broad-based evergreen way. So one of our businesses largely uses the ability to curate conversations into your inbox by helping you through an element of art and science using automation and very intentional understanding of who you are to send out invitations to those with whom you want to connect with in an automated way that doesn't feel like automation, which is why our conversions in those cold invites are happening anywhere between 15 to 20% higher than anybody else in the marketplace. What that does, though, is allow us to allow individuals to recognize that they can connect based on an introduction on who you are and actually go in to show that you want something for the person you're connecting with, not just from them, by sending out an immediate cold DM pitch, right? I'm not a big fan of cold selling on any of the social platforms. The sliding into people's DMs, shooting a messages on, start with who you are. Let's build a relationship and see if there's a place to take it from here. The second business on that is a podcast booking business. After being on over 400 shows in the last 2 years myself, I realized how broken the space is, but how valuable this asset is. And so we've got a business that we started about 9 months ago that is doing basically podcast booking service based on download guarantees that also includes rev share for the podcast host, because our business wouldn't exist without their asset. And so the reality of it is that this is another great way where someone can demonstrate who they are to the world, track who they want to impact in an evergreen broad-based level. But for one of the first times ever in the podcasting space, we're able to actually give people ROI and allow them to understand their reach, how many people actually capture their message, and that it's in direct alignment with their audience. So that from a marketing budget perspective, this opens up opportunities for other people to invest in this medium that you and I believe deeply in.
I love it. And like I said, I want to say I'm so grateful for you and Wyatt and Joe. You know, you guys have all become part of my ecosystem, and I'm very humbled and grateful. Now, don't think I'm going to let you get away with the whole scissors and string thing. You gotta, I'm not going to let you. That's why I wrote it down so I didn't forget. Talk to me for a second about that.
Yeah, so this requires a little bit of context because it does set it up a little bit, but I'll go quick because I want people to understand this. Reality of it is I believe that the human experience is rooted in four areas. We all seek and desire to feel safe. We all seek and desire to feel protected, and those aren't the same thing. We all seek and desire to feel seen and understood, and we all seek and desire to feel protected. The reality of it is if we recognize that if we go into an environment, we don't feel seen and understood, and we don't feel connected, often we don't feel protected, which means we don't feel safe. So what do we do in that situation? We all of a sudden put our armor up to protect ourselves. What happens when we put our armor up is three things. First of all, we immediately prevent exactly what we want, which is to be seen, understood, and connect, because our armor creates this invisible force field that makes it impossible for us to demonstrate effectively who we are to anybody on the outside of that force field. And how can we expect anybody on the outside of that armor that we're carrying to actually see and understand us at the deepest levels of who we are? The second thing that armor does, Richard, how long could you hold 2 5-pound dumbbells out in front of you?
Not very long.
Couple of minutes, right? And the longer you hold it, the heavier it gets, right? By the way, our armor's no different. We put up armor thinking we're protecting ourselves, but the longer we carry it, the heavier it gets. It starts incrementally crushing us. It literally starts to take the life out of us, and it's already prevented us from getting what we want, which is to be seen and understood and connected. The third thing it does is people have a container, right? The world tells us, we've already talked about this, to cut off the emotions at the top, shove them down, right? So just like a trash can, we've got a container. Now, those that are loosey-goosey with their container will shove it down. But when it gets too full, it starts spilling over the top, having an impact on other people in their world. And then there's people like myself that were really, really controlled, right? So I couldn't let anybody even know that I had that container. So I screwed that lid on really, really tight, and it was filled with pressure, but I kept shoving more in. Well, when that pressure continues to build, what happens to the container? At some point, it's like a bomb and goes off, creating a ripple effect of damage in your world, which I did. Okay. So one of our biggest things that we focus on is really helping people understand that as leaders in life and in business, that we have to assume and put ourselves in positions where we believe that we're safe so that we can be the protectors and connectors in every environment we go into. Because if we can go in with our armor down and we can facilitate an environment where everybody is protected, then everybody's safe, everybody's protected, everybody's seen and understood, and everybody's connected. But there's this fear to drop our armor, right? Because we're afraid of vulnerability. Now, I believe that vulnerability and authenticity are the glue that binds human connection. And I believe that true strength actually hides behind vulnerability. So I had this conversation about surrender and dropping armor with a very big name in a very big sport. And I'm going to save this individual, right? But it's a sport that often is focused on the external image of the individual being judged at a very high level. This individual was at the highest of highest levels in the sport in the world. And so going back to compete, I ultimately was talking to him about this concept and that this path now is going to look different than it used to for him. And he said, Brian, what if I lose my edge? So I've never thought about this until that moment. This was about 2.5 months ago, but immediately what popped in my head was a question. And I responded back to him and I said, do you know how they cut soap? Do you know how they cut cheese? Do you know, Richard?
Scissors?
With a string. A string pulled at the proper intention intentionally. They can cut through bodies. Strings can absolutely cut through us. Yeah. So here's the thing. I started to equate this idea of armor with edge. Well, if it's an edge, then it's a knife, right? We always talk about knives, you know, sharpen the edge. Make sure that iron sharpens iron. We got to make sure that we're here. Well, a knife has a very specific job. It has a beveled, sharp edge. It's hard. It's fixed. It has one intended purpose, to cut things. Right? And so what happens when our armor is up, we really have a knife out in front of us as well, severing the connections with people. Because as our armor goes up, we actually cut off the ability for people to see us and understand us and connect with us. But also in that container model, we as the edge are actually creating these little micro cuts of damage in the people around us for the things we haven't dealt with because we're still carrying our armor. So I said, what if you were a string instead? A string can cut. A string can cut through anything that it's needed. Right? Pulled at the proper tension. But the cool thing about string is you can also remove the tension. It can be turned up in a swing. It can be rolled up in a ball. It can be tied into a bow. And he said, yeah, but what if I came at you with my knife while you were holding your string? I'd cut right through the string. And I said, yeah, but that's assuming that the string is fixed into one position. But remember, we can remove the tension. So when your blade hits my knife, I can put my string and wrap all the way around your knife, giving you a hug and also diffusing the sharpness of your blade. So I just often want people to reflect on the fact that if we are the string, we've said often in our household that we have an invisible string connecting our hearts to our kids no matter where we are. So when I'm traveling, when I'm not home, we always remind ourselves of that invisible string. But as the protector and connector in my life and in my business, I can also wrap a string around every environment I'm in, again, guaranteeing that everybody's safe, everybody's protected, everybody's seen and understood, and everybody's connected. So I always ask everybody, do you want to be the knife and sever and disconnect? Or do you want to be the string and deeply connect and allow all of us to get what we actually want?
Wow, I love that. I think we're actually going to name this episode "The Knife and the String." I think that's totally awesome. So now, how do we find you? How do we support your mission?
At Bogert Brian, if you're a social person, or brianbogert.com if you are a web person. And then I'm also going to give a gift with a giant caveat. If you go to nolimitsprelude.com. That is a free course that we developed and offered. It is the full introduction and the chapter one of our entire full course, allowing you to begin with the end in mind so that you can build your life of intentional alignment to die empty. The reality of it is, yes, to go there and get access to it, we get your email. Yes, you're going to get a handful of emails through completing the process. And yes, when you complete the process, you're going to get 4 emails from us outlining opportunities to engage further. I tell you all that because I have no desire to funnel you. I want you to have full disclosure entering into this, but this is also a gift. And whether or not you purchase at the end, you will get value out of this process. And what we realize is that moved people move people. If it moves you and you don't purchase, all I'm asking is move it through the world. Give the free element to someone else with the same disclosures I gave you. Because the reality of it is I want to move as many people as possible, because when more people we move, the more people we move. And so that's where we want to create impact. And that's truly what we're all about. So I'm asking for help to get collective impact to a billion lives as quickly as possible.
And I'm all about helping. So I just wanted to say thank you. I'm truly humbled and grateful for your friendship. And hopefully this builds generational relationships. So guys, definitely check out Brian. I mean, as soon as I send him a message on LinkedIn, he responds right back. As soon as I send him a message on Facebook, he responds right back. So he's amazing. He's available. He's that kind of guy. So definitely check out Brian and everything he's doing. Guys, if you love coffee, check out Vertical Momentum Coffee. We're saving lives and changing lives. And I want to, once again, I want to thank Joe from 150K Podcast. And I want to thank Wyatt. You're truly amazing. Thank you so much. You made it so easy to get in touch with Brian. So guys, I love you guys and I appreciate you. Like Oprah says, you know, the best way to help yourself is to help others. So guys, just please reach out and help somebody today. Guys, remember, vertical momentum, the only way to go is but up. Have an amazing 4th of July. Please be safe and God bless you. Have a great weekend, guys.